This is Ridgely Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, a conversation with the executive director of the Hoosier Environmental Council, Jesse Carbonda. He'll talk about what the nonprofit agency's 2018 legislative priorities are. And they included an issue that is not typically an environmental issue that's up for consideration during the General Assembly session. We'll find out more. Also, too, we'll bring you the premiere episode of Green Fleet Radio with your host, Carl Lissick, as well as we'll have the latest from Peter Novak of the Greater Northwest Indiana Association of Realtors, how home sales did in the end of 2017, and a look to 2018. That, as well as the Lakeshore Focus episode with Keith Kirkpatrick coming up later. The 2018 General Assembly is in session. Let's find out more about some of the priorities, in particular from the Hoosier Environmental Council in the legislative session underway. And for that, let's turn to Jesse Carbonda. He's Executive Director of the Hoosier Environmental Council. Jesse, welcome to the show.
Always great to be with you, Chris.
Well, fill us in on some of the items that you folks have on the agenda and priorities for the General Assembly this session.
Well, Chris, it's interesting. This is going to be my 11th session as Executive Director of Hoosier Environmental Council, and I'm happy to report that this session, our priorities, our top five priorities, are all proactive as opposed to defensive. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty heartening for us. We have no illusions about how challenging that will be, but we're very glad to be focused on the positive. And the kind of five topics we're going to be focused on are redistricting reform, improving rural quality of life, protecting our old growth forest areas, facilitating more improvements of our wastewater and drinking water infrastructure, and finally facilitating more solar energy.
Now, it's interesting you should mention redistricting. That's not exactly what folks would consider as an environmental related issue, but in this case there definitely is. Tell us about that.
Well, the thing is that Indiana's legislative districts are among the most gerrymandered in America, according to a study by the University of Chicago. And that obviously has repercussions on all sorts of public policy issues, including the environment. So what you might have is a situation, as we've certainly seen in Indianapolis, where the state legislative districts are so skewed that basically you have a situation like Marion County, where Indianapolis is located, and that is carved out into several state legislative districts. And each legislative district is carved out in such a way that the rural and suburban communities that outlie Marion County kind of swarm the urban communities of Indianapolis. So if you're in one of those districts, it's possible that your urban voice may be diluted by the rural and suburban interests in your district. Other things for us to consider when thinking about why we're involved in trying to reform redistricting in our state is that in non-competitive districts, it leads to situations where lawmakers can afford to ignore a large degree of discontent by a portion of their constituency. And nowhere was this more in play than in this, with respect to this controversial bill, SB 309, that anti-solar energy bill. You know, you'd have situations where constituents would be calling their lawmaker, 100 no votes to zero yes votes, and yet the lawmaker would vote for the bill. Mm-hmm. And that's because of this perception that there's a portion of people in their district that just don't matter because of the way the district is drawn.
Mm-hmm. What kind of chances do you think there may be in seeing some changes based on the concerns that the HEC has about how these folks are represented in whatever issue, in particular in the environmentally related issues?
Well, fortunately, there will be a hearing in the Senate on January 22nd, next week, mm-hmm. in the Senate Elections Committee, in which there will definitely be a discussion on redistricting reform. There's a couple of competing bills there. One bill that's fairly narrow in scope and basically establishes a set of criteria by which maps should be drawn, such as that counties and cities should be as much together as possible. But that's not enough in terms of trying to create redistricting reform. And so we back a bill that's interestingly championed entirely by Republicans. called SB 159, in which, including, and one of the sponsors, by the way, is from your part of the state, Senator Bocek.
Mm-hmm.
And that bill would create a redistricting commission, an independent redistricting commission that would consist of a combination of people designated by the legislative leaders of the General Assembly, as well as those that are selected by Indiana's seven public universities, where they kind of vet regular citizens. So it's a wholly independent commission for which they get input from the Legislative Services Agency to write the maps, but the maps are very much written with the public interest in mind and not with the self-interest of politicians.
We're talking with Jesse Carbonda, who is Executive Director of the Hoosier Environmental Council, about the HEC's legislative priorities this session that's underway. And Jesse, you mentioned also, too, that one of the concerns that that your group has is one that is concerned across the entire state, but in particular points to the south of us here. It's about clean drinking water. And I know that one of our area representatives, State Representative from Valparaiso, Ed Soliday, has been very concerned about infrastructure dealing with not only with water, but with sewage and the like, because a lot of it is old, deteriorating, needs to be replaced, but it's a very expensive proposition. I suppose it'd be the same way, too, if you're talking about trying to find new ways and better ways to bring safe drinking water across Indiana.
That's right. That's right. Representative Soliday, as well as his counterpart, Senator Ed Charbonneau, also Valparaiso, both of them are proposing bills that are to create a task force for water infrastructure, HB 1267 and SB 361.
Mm-hmm.
And these bills, again, can consist of a diversity of stakeholders whose aim is to provide some recommendations of how we can go about financing significant improvements in our drinking water and wastewater infrastructure. And not only would that, of course, improve our drinking water quality across the state, but it would also reduce the amount of pollution going into our waterways, since wastewater is a major source of water pollution to our streams and lakes across Indiana. You know, one of the things that we would like to make sure becomes a part of this infrastructure task force's scope is efficiency, which is oftentimes the American cultural way is let's keep building, building, building. But it's so important that we save. So make sure that we're doing everything possible to incentivize utilities to reduce leakages and incentivize customers to do the very best they can to save water on their end, whether that's incentivizing energy efficient water faucets or energy efficient toilets, or finding means to maybe use rainwater to irrigate their backyard.
Now, Jesse, I know that the HEC is spending a lot more time devoted to these proactive issues that you mentioned about the concern about redistricting and how make sure that everybody has the right opportunity to say what they feel about issues that come up. And you mentioned just now talking about the concerns about water infrastructure in Indiana. Are there any other issues that you hope that the HEC supports that you'd like to see the lawmakers take up this time?
Absolutely. Last session, we took a giant step backwards when Governor Holcomb signed into law SEA 309, which phases out net metering in Indiana in over a five-year period.
Mm-hmm.
And net metering is the principal means by which we try to make rooftop solar more attractive to homeowners, business owners, churches, hospitals, et cetera, farms, et cetera. And the basic idea is that when you have excess power coming from your rooftop solar system, that goes back on the grid, and that excess power gets credited on your electricity bill. So you get a significantly smaller bill.
Mm-hmm.
Now, while we suffered a major setback last session, thankfully, there are some attempts to remedy the damage from last session, notably a bill called HB 1069, which attempts to extend net metering for schools and for municipalities from 15 years to 20 years. So, in other words, if someone signs up in the next, say, this year, say it's a school that wants to sign up for a solar system in the current year, rather than having 15 years of net metering, they could have up to 20 years of net metering, which would be a significant improvement to the financing of the system.
Well, it sounds like, Jesse, that even though this is a shorter session than usual, because it's not a budgetary session, that there are a lot of issues coming up here, but at least the HEC is going to keep a close eye on some of these very important issues, and hope you'll be able to check back in with us and let us know how the lawmakers deal with these issues. We appreciate you talking about them today.
Absolutely, Chris. Glad to. And Chris, I hope you will encourage your supporters to look at hecweb.org, mm-hmm. the website, because we have a specific page called BillWatch 2018.
Ah, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, where we're trying to educate the public in terms of the status of the big environmental issues facing the state.
That's right. I do check that on occasion, and I definitely will on these issues to be sure. Jesse Carbonta is the executive director of the Hoosier Environmental Council. And now the premiere episode of Green Fleet Radio and your host, Carl Lissick.
Well, good morning and welcome to the Green Radio Network. Today, our guest is Mr. Sean Seals. He's the Senior Environmental Manager from the Indiana Department of Environmental Management, and Mr. Ryan Klum, the Communications Director for IDEM. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, we got some exciting news talking about sustainable transportation in Indiana. Can you tell us, Sean and Ryan, about the Volkswagen Mitigation Diesel Emissions Settlement Program?
Well, as most have heard by now, Volkswagen recently finalized a consent decree with the U.S. Department of Justice resulting from VW's installation and use of emissions testing defeat devices on most of their 2- and 3-liter diesel engines. These devices recognized when the vehicles were on the road versus in a testing cycle. When they were on the road, the defeat devices turned off the emission control equipment to allow for better fuel economy, but resulted in excess nitrogen oxides, commonly known as NOx emissions. The goal of, and the objective of the VW Mitigation Trust is to implement diesel emission reduction projects that mitigate these excess NOx emissions. The Indiana Volkswagen Mitigation Trust program will use nearly $41 million to lower NOx emissions across Indiana.
So, Sean, why is reducing NOx emissions or nitrous oxide so important?
That's a great question, Carl. NOx emissions are actually one of the precursors that form ground-level ozone. High levels of ground-level ozone can cause respiratory issues for many Hoosiers. More sensitive populations, including children and senior citizens, asthma sufferers, and the like, can find it difficult to breathe on air quality action days with high levels of ozone.
So as you talk about these mitigation funds, $41 million, Sean, that just sounds like an enormous amount of money. Who will be able to apply for these funds?
The Indiana Volkswagen Mitigation Trust program is open to both public and private entities alike. The majority of the project types specifically identified in the consent decree deal with model year 1992 through 2009 medium to heavy-duty diesel equipment. These types of equipment include trucks, buses, switcher locomotives, marine vessels, port cargo handling equipment, and even airport ground support equipment. Through the program, these vehicles and equipment, or their diesel-powered engines, can be replaced with cleaner alternatives. In addition, projects that reduce idling or create electric vehicle infrastructure will also be eligible. So, whether you're a small company or a large city, you are equally eligible for funding through the Indiana Volkswagen Mitigation Trust program.
So, Sean, I know we've done a variety of outreach events currently in northern Indiana in regards to some of the opportunities with Volkswagen, but how can the public get involved with this process?
There are actually two phases to the Indiana program, Carl. The first phase, where we are right now, is our request for stakeholder input on the Beneficiary Mitigation Plan draft framework. Right now, we're taking formal input from all Indiana stakeholders on how they believe these funds should be allocated across the eligible project types. Later this year, we will venture into the second phase of our program, where we will be opening the program for project applications. In the summer of 2018, we are hoping to begin taking applications for funding through the Indiana Volkswagen Mitigation Trust program. Details on what projects are eligible, as well as the process to apply, will be clearly stated on our VW Trust website.
And where can listeners go for more information on that, Sean?
Indiana has set up a specific website for more information on the Indiana program. The website can be found at www.in.gov/VW Trust. And as always, you're safer using lowercase when you input a URL. The website will serve as our primary mechanism for communicating the most up-to-date information on where we are in the process, as well as any new developments along the way. When folks visit the website for the first time, they'll be able to provide their email address to sign up for automated updates, and we encourage everyone interested to sign up as early as possible. The website is also where you will find the current version of the Beneficiary Mitigation Plan draft framework document. That is currently open for stakeholder input and comment. Information on how to provide comments as well as contact information are also contained on the website.
And Ryan and Sean, is there any closing thoughts that you would like to elaborate on to our listeners?
I don't believe there's anything else to add other than we're very excited to have an opportunity to work with everyone across the state of Indiana to mitigate these NOx emissions and truly make a difference across the state.
Well, we're excited to be a partner with IDEM and the many other partners that the state is working on to get this message out. And that will do it for today's edition of the Green Fleet Radio. I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks again to our guests, Mr. Sean Seals and Mr. Ryan Clem from the Indiana Department of Environmental Management. And Green Fleet Radio airs three times every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Radio. Be sure to join and tune in to visit us online at southshorecleancities.org. And thanks for joining us. And remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy.
That's Carl Lissick with Green Fleet Radio. And you can hear Green Fleet Radio on Wednesdays here on Regionally Speaking. And podcasts of Green Fleet Radio are also available online at lakeshorepublicradio.org as well as on NPR One. Just search for WLPR. This is Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. As far as Northwest Indiana is concerned for the housing stock that we are looking at here, we check in on Peter Novak, who's the president and CEO of the Greater Northwest Indiana Association of Realtors. And we check with him on time to time to find out how a particular month's home sales and the costs and all are doing. We'll take a little broader look here. Look at what we see so far for the year that's just about to end. Pete, thanks for being with us today.
Oh, my pleasure, Chris. Thank you for having me.
Let's take a look first here. We'll look at November. That's the latest data that you happen to have available. And how do things seem to shape up here for the housing here in Northwest Indiana?
Well, you know, the market conditions have been pretty similar all year, and really for the last couple of years. It's just a situation where demand remains high, and that part we continue to remain excited about. But really continue to be constrained by low supply, low inventory of homes for sale. And it's been something that, I don't want to call it a mystery, but certainly I've asked my members often why sellers aren't selling, and I don't seem to get a consensus answer. But the one consensus that we can say for sure is that there's a lot of buyer demand out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess in a way that's good. I mean, the people want to buy houses, but it's really tough, though, I'm sure, if you don't have enough houses to sell or not the, quite the ones that people seem to want.
Well, it does. It makes it tough because certainly we're of the opinion more home sales could occur if there was more supply, more houses for sale. And the other downside to not having enough supply is that prices continue to increase, which is good if you are an existing homeowner, but bad if you are a home buyer.
Yeah.
Because that means you're going to pay more for the home than you probably want to. But that's just, you know, the current status of the market today.
Now, we know that the Greater Association has seven counties within its purview. Are there any counties in particular that seem to have more problems with either the number of homes available or the sales or the cost per home?
No, I mean, it's across the board. This is a national problem, and certainly you could look at one month's data and see discrepancies or ups and downs. But I think overall, if you looked at the overall numbers, it's fairly consistent. You know, home sales are slightly outpacing what they were last year. And of course, median selling price, once again, like it has for the last 2 or 3 years, is up pretty high. I think this year we're 6.6% for all counties year to date in terms of the median selling price. As of through November, so for the first 11 months of the year, we're up 1.6% in terms of the total number of units sold. Last year was, you know, a very good year in terms of the number of units sold. So, you know, if we match that or surpass it, which is the way it looks like we'll do, we'll consider that to be a successful year. But, again, prices rising are a good thing, but rising too much certainly for the long term can be a concern as well.
Mm-hmm. When you take a look at across the board at all of the counties together within the association, and you talk with your fellow realtors and the locations in whatever county they happen to be in, do they tell you any particular things that they note that they've run into here so far to the year, at this point here in the year, where they've had trouble trying to sell homes or look for the right kind of homes for clients that they've had?
Well, not necessarily. Again, I would say it's been across the board, but I think, you know, you can look at and see sort of the entry level homes. The lower priced homes are the ones that are being competed for a little bit more heavily. While it is true there's low supply also on the high end of the market, that end of the market's a little bit more fluid. Obviously, you have less buyers generally on the higher end. So I would say, you know, mostly on the first-time home buying, it's been a little bit of a struggle. So those, you know, lower-priced homes, I think, are the ones that are certainly there's more competition for. So I would probably say that in the market is definitely a little bit more fierce.
That's interesting because I don't drive around and look specifically for houses, at least not anymore anyway. But when I was looking, I was looking around, and I noticed even now, just without having to have a reason to look, I do see a lot of for sale signs out, and we're talking about sales signs that are put up not only by registered realtors, but also in some cases by individuals looking to sell their particular home. And I realize in some cases that we have people here that are maybe they're empty nesters now. They have all their family members out, and it's just the husband and wife and the family, and they've realized that they don't necessarily need this big a house to take care of any longer. So, and even if we're talking here about a home that would probably be a perfect first-time home for somebody.
Yeah, again, I mean, one of the issues when you have a low supply market is that there's various different relief valves that occur. I mean, we've talked about new construction in the past being a relief valve for us, and I know the home builders have said this year that things have picked up as well. I've talked to people just about general new developments in terms of entire subdivisions. When you look at that, that's something that has not necessarily matched, if you will, some of the numbers that we were seeing in the mid-2000s. But in talking to people, they're telling me they're starting to see those things come more online. So those would, be things that would be relief valves. And usually when people say new construction, a lot of people think of the nice luxury home or, you know, the high-end home. And that's not necessarily true. I mean, we're, you know, again, you can see developments that might cater more towards not necessarily first-time home buyers, because certainly they have usually a more difficult time purchasing new construction with just some of the down payment requirements and all of that stuff. But for people on sort of that end of the market, that certainly is a segment that, you know, we haven't seen as robust as we have in the past. And those are things that I'm hearing are improving, and hopefully that'll be the case here in the coming year, where we'll start to see some of that stuff take shape and start to relieve this whole supply issue. Or, again, we could start to see where sellers just finally start, you know, putting their homes up for sale for whatever reasons that they do, whether they're, you know, again, moving up or moving down, whether they're feeling better about the economy. I know we had obviously a big tax cut that just occurred, and so who knows how that'll change people's opinions about where things are going. And all of those things factor in when someone decides to sell. And a lot of times, as we mentioned, the interest rates can be as low as possible. You could think you're getting a tax cut, but there's usually life-changing reasons why people end up selling a home. You mentioned it. Kids are grown. They went to college, and people are trying to downgrade.
Right.
Or obviously they're expanding their family and are looking for more, you know, more house to be able to put their family in. So all of those things combined kind of make up whether we have people that are willing to sell and also buy. And so I think they're kind of good problems to have. I don't want to make it seem like we're not excited. I mean, we just, as long as demand stays high in my book, that'll be a good thing for the housing market.
So I suppose if we got together, say, in March or April of next year, when things seem to have shaken out a bit more here concerning the tax reform changes that Congress has passed and have been signed into law, and people actually get to see what kind of changes that they will actually get to face here, or you know, and whenever they decide to make their big moves here in the future, they might have something different to say. Certainly we'll have a better idea, too, on how the housing market's going to be into 2018 by then, I would think.
Yeah, sure. Again, I mean, I think all indications at this point from a lot of the analysts we follow and things of that nature that, you know, we're going to see a positive 2018. I think the question for us is how much better could it be? I mean, can we start to see some of these things that we're pointing to as constraints and issues? Can some of those things start to work themselves out in the market? And that's kind of what we'll be watching for in the coming year.
Okay. Peter Novak is the president and CEO of the Greater Northwest Indiana Association of Realtors. 7 counties here in Northwest Indiana come under the association. And as always, Pete, thanks for taking time to talk with us today. And happy holidays to you and everybody there at the association. We appreciate you sharing the information with us. We'll look forward to talking again here pretty soon into 2018.
My pleasure, Chris, and likewise to you and Lakeshore Public Radio as well.
This is Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. This Lakeshore Focus episode focuses on public safety and the life of today's firefighters in Northwest Indiana. Here's host Keith Kirkpatrick.
Several months ago, we produced a show called The World of Cops. It was a fascinating look at what the life of a police officer is like today. Well, it seemed like we should give equal time to the firefighters. Actually, they threatened that my house might not be protected unless they got equal time. No, they didn't. I was put in touch with them because a new fire training academy is opening in Northwest Indiana. On our show today, we have 2 veteran firefighters and leaders who are working hard to keep us safe, including me. Let's meet Tom Pfeiffer, who is the fire chief for the Portage Fire Department, and Mike Parks, division chief for Crown Point Fire Rescue, and also the training coordinator for the District 1 Firefighter Training Council. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
So I'm a little concerned. Should I be concerned if I've got firefighters here, that my house and everybody else's are still okay right now?
Well, yeah. I mean, when you see us in white shirts, well, Mike's a little bit different, but I don't go to fires too much anymore unless it's really big. As the chief of the department, I spend more time on budgets and in my office.
All that kind of boring stuff?
Yeah, the stuff that you never want to do when you're a firefighter, that stuff.
But you've both been in the trenches, right?
So how absolutely. Long have you been in the trenches? We come from different departments. We have a combination department. We have 32 career guys, and we also have 32 paid on call or volunteers. So we come from a much different organization. So it's changed over the years. We put on additional people each year on the career side because of the demands.
How long have you been doing this?
26 years. I started in 1991, and things have really changed.
Wow. Okay. So how long have you been doing this?
I also started in 91, and I started as a volunteer in the Chesterton Fire Department, and then I moved to National Steel on their fire department, and then in 94 I started a career in the city of Portage, so I've been in Portage since.
So you've talked about your department is made up of both professionals and volunteers, or full-time people and volunteers. Is yours the same way?
No. So Portage is a completely full-time professional department. We staff 19 people a day, spanning 3 fire stations to cover the entire city.
Okay. But some fire departments, what's the difference between when they're all volunteer and, I mean, how do we know which is which?
Funding is the biggest thing. There are some communities that simply can't afford a full career department because it's very expensive. And their call volume may not be so high. So as Tom did, I started out as a volunteer, and then I also went to U.S. Steel as a firefighter in industry, and then I moved over as a career firefighter to Crown Point.
So you mentioned things have really changed since you started in this. Tell me about a couple of things that have really changed, both of you. What changed?
Back in the day, I mean, they gave you some gear, some boots and a coat, and they said, okay, there's the truck, here's a pager. When this thing goes off, meet us at the station, we'll show you what to do. That's pretty much how it started back in the day, you know.
Back in the 90s?
Yes.
That's how we were protecting our
absolutely.
Homes and things?
Absolutely. I mean, it was a little more structured than that, but compared to today, it's really changed. I mean, when I started, I mean, you're talking probably 24 to 40 hours worth of training, roughly. Now, the average recruit is getting 350, maybe even 400 hours of training before he is cleared to make an emergency response and enter into a burning building.
Wow.
So it's really changed.
So what do you see as the differences besides the training?
Well, and a lot of it is just we're not firefighters. I mean, I like to tell people fire is our middle name. We do so much more. EMS is a huge component and in both of our departments. Being a paramedic and responding on the ambulance is a lot of what every fire department does today. So it's just not as simple as being trained to a firefighter level. You have to be trained much greater than that to be a paramedic and respond on the medical side also.
Do you think down the road that title will change to more of emergency responders, I mean, or something broader, or is it always going to be?
I think it already has. I mean, they're firefighter paramedics, and 80 to 85% of our runs are typically ambulance runs where we're providing emergency medical services. All of our career members have to be paramedics, as do the members of Portage. So it really has changed everything we do. You know, I would agree with Tom. It's not just being a firefighter anymore. It's really being a paramedic, and occasionally we catch a fire.
So how much difference is there in response or emergencies that come up? I mean, are there less fires today than there used to be? It seemed like we put in sprinkler systems and everything, and everybody's supposed to have fire extinguishers. So is it different?
Fire calls have gone down a lot in the last 25 years. That's designed, and that's what we want, yes.
Right.
You know, one of the things I always tell my city officials is I want a year with no fires. I mean, that's the goal. You don't pay us to be there to put out the fire. You pay us to be there to make sure the fire never happens. So, you know, it's a lot of education and stuff up front to make sure that we don't have fires through building inspections, education down to the kindergarten level of making sure that kids understand what to do if they have a fire and then how not to have fires. So,
well, let's talk about the education thing. That's kind of your middle name, right?
Pretty
education
much.
Or training is your middle name?
Pretty much.
But it sounds like it's everybody's middle name. So what is all this training particularly, what are you doing to educate the community particularly?
We have programs where we go into the schools. We have programs where the schools come to us. We have daycare centers that come to do tours of the fire station, and we're always trying to spread the message of fire prevention. We also do it, like Tom said, through the Fire Prevention Bureau. We have an inspection bureau that goes out and inspects all the businesses in the Crown Point jurisdiction and check them for fire code violations.
So what's some of the primary messaging that when you're talking to kids, adults, anybody, I mean, what do you want them to walk away with from your educational presentation? What do you want them to, I hate to use the term, burned into their brain, right? What do you want them to really hang on to?
Well, a lot of them vary on age. You know, the very young children, we want them to understand, to recognize a problem and to call 911. And as they get older, we start talking about not playing with matches, et cetera. But, you know, it varies by age. And that's one of the things that we're focusing on now. We have a group of people that are revamping our fire prevention education program to address the different age groups because it's very age specific. All the way up to seniors, even senior citizens, they have a much different message, you know, like making sure they don't trip, rugs, trip hazards, because we get a lot of falls where they fall down and break their hip. So it's not just fire prevention, it's really injury prevention, and it goes all the way from kindergarten up to senior citizens.
And I think it focuses a lot on just safety in general. It doesn't have to be fire prevention, but just the overall safety of how to make sure you're safe, how to make sure your home is safe, and how to make sure that you, if when you get into a situation, what to do, and to have that planned already of how you're going to respond. You know, for most people, we hope that that's their first and only fire. You know, it might be a millionth fire, but for them, we don't. You know, we want them to that one time they know how to respond because that's their only fire that they've ever been to.
I've never thought about this before, but police respond when somebody is going to hurt you. But I bet we hurt ourselves a lot more than anybody else hurting us. I wonder what the statistics are. We probably are 6 or 10 times more likely to hurt ourselves, trip, fall,
damage ourselves than probably for somebody to come up and push or shove us or hit us.
Well, and right? As Mike said too, as we, you know, as we age, and we're, you know, we're an aging society, as that happens, you know, the opportunity is much greater. And as Tom mentioned, there's a lot of, we're tasked with so many more things than just firefighting. You know, we have a car seat education program teaching parents to put their kids in car seats the right way. We have a Project Lifesaver program where Alzheimer's and dementia patients are placed with a band so that if they wander from home, we can find them. You know, there's just so many things that we're tasked with. The firefighting is honestly just a small fraction of what we're expected to do, and that's changed over the years since when I started.
You know, I think the depiction of firefighters historically has been, you know, I mean, you're kind of in this stressful job waiting for the, you know, the bell to go off and slide down the pole. Do they even use the poles anymore?
We have one.
Yeah, we do too.
Is it just for fun or?
No.
Our guys use it.
Okay.
It's much quicker to go down that pole than the stairs.
Okay. So anyway, I think people's idea is like you're just waiting and then all of a sudden there's all this tension and you're in the truck and there's a fire and everything. It sounds different. It sounds like the pressure.
It's not waiting. Generally, we're doing something else, like a fire prevention inspection or a car seat or doing an ambulance run, and that's when the fire comes in. Very rarely are we sitting around doing nothing and the bell rings.
Yeah, all the tension and all the things that you talked about are that is still there. That's very much so. But the days of us just sitting around waiting for the bell to go off is not the case. It's training. It's, you know, being prepared. It's, you know, if it's not EMS training, it's fire training. If it's not fire training, it's some kind of public education program. It's a, you know, it's a bicycle safety helmet.
Hazmat.
Rodeo that we're going on or a hazmat. There's just.
Do you feel like when you're doing the education piece or, you know, even fire inspections or anything, how much do you feel like if I don't do this right, these people could get hurt? They don't listen or don't pay attention. I mean, does that feel like some level of pressure to you?
Well, yeah, I think because we want to make sure that we're sending a good message so that way people can know how to respond in the appropriate manner. And you know, the hard part is if you're looking at a lifelong of education to people, you know, most departments, if we think about this, most departments really started a public education program about 15 years ago, would you say, Mike, about 15 years ago? So if you start with those people in first grade, they're 5 or 6. So now those people are in their 20s. So everybody older than that probably had a very, very small segment of education from the fire department. One of the first days I got on the job in Portage, my parents came to visit me. And, you know, I had been a volunteer on Chesterton for about 3 years at that point. So I had been in the station and everything. And when my mom walked in, she was like, I didn't realize how big this fire truck is. She had no clue. I mean, it's a semi sitting in the building.
Right.
They're just so huge. And I'm thinking, how does my mom, who I'm a firefighter, who I'm supposed to be teaching the public, how does my mom not understand how big the fire engine is?
Right.
You know, so that was kind of my light of, wow, public education from the fire department when my mom was a kid probably wasn't as good as it needs to be or where it is today.
Well, I look at those trucks when I'm seeing them out, I'm like, that looks really complicated to operate. There's just a whole lot of bells and whistles and buttons on those things.
That's another big change. I mean, things have gotten really expensive. I mean, it is really expensive to buy those big fancy trucks now, which places additional burden on the fire departments.
You've got to keep all the equipment up because it's got to be working. Can each of you maybe talk about a time where you felt in your career, I mean, you really felt you made a difference. I mean, you did something that's like, man, I just feel really good about being in this job and doing what I just did.
You know, that's kind of hard. I think that's a really hard question to answer because I think it every day, even as a chief now, every day when I go home, I feel like I've done something to, you know, my role today is to improve firefighters' lives, right? To make sure that they have the tools so they can go out and improve other people's lives. But I think every day when I go home, I think that I've accomplished something that's going to, you know, make it better. So I think it's really hard just to pinpoint one. I mean, I can think of times where I've, you've given birth or you help assist. Mom gives birth.
I started to say this could be really interesting.
Mom's giving birth, but you're there to do the things that you need to do. And, you know, on those occasions, you feel really, you know, that's like, like the most, probably one of the most exciting things we do other than running into a burning
I saved
building.
A life or brought a life into the world. Yeah.
Generally, every call that we go on is very similar to that, though, because generally people call us in their time of need. It may be something that we think is really simple, but they obviously have an emergency that they can't deal with, whether it's water backing up in their home, a water pipe, a sewer backup, a cat in a tree, you name it. I mean, they call us and they need help. So, you know,
You're right, and a lot of us will look at that and kind of chuckle, perhaps, and say, well, a cat in the tree, whatever. But if that cat is that woman's
absolutely.
Companion.
It was important enough for them to call 911 and us to respond. So we take that very seriously.
What do you look for in people who are coming into the ranks of professional firefighters these days? I mean, what kind of characteristics, if you have candidates coming in?
A lifelong desire to learn, because it never ends. You know, our profession keeps evolving. They have to be willing to change. They have to be willing to get continuing ed in all the different subjects. They have to be able to become a paramedic. That's one of our requirements, and that's very difficult. You're talking about a 2,000-hour program. It takes well over a year, sometimes a year and a half to get through. And they have to be able to do that. So we have to evaluate.
So this is way more than a high school education these
days.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, and you also have to care. One thing you can get through a lot of things. The one thing you can't get through is caring. Like Mike said, when you show up there, these people, whatever the problem may be, is the biggest problem that they've ever had. And if you don't care enough to realize that that's their biggest problem, then you can't, you just can't continue to do this day in and day out. Because if you don't care about their problem, then you don't care to solve their problem. And we're there for one reason, and that's to solve
problems.
How
do you figure out if a candidate has that quality? Because I think you're right. You can't really teach that, right?
No.
It's hard to teach. But how can you determine if somebody walks in and says, I'm interested, I've applied for a job here, you're interviewing me. How do you figure out if I really care?
We were actually just talking about this, prior to coming in for the interview, and it's interesting because being a combination department, we have the opportunity to put them on a long-term job evaluation or job interview, because we may see them for 6 months or a year or 2 years before we hire to the career ranks. So we have a really good opportunity to get to know people before we hire them as careers.
So
we almost use that as a farm team, using a baseball analogy. We use that as a way to recruit our career members.
You're talking about the volunteer
corps. Yeah, the volunteer
corps
component,
that kind of supports the fire department.
So we have a little bit of an advantage on that, whereas Tom probably relies more on his interview process.
Well, but I would say this, though, even in our situation as being a fully career department, most of the people that are applying are coming from they're already in a volunteer organization.
Yeah, they may be one of my volunteers.
Right, they might be one of his volunteers.
Would you accept a good recommendation from him?
Well, we work together.
Yeah, we've hired people and they've hired people. So yeah, that it's come back.
We've stolen
forth.
Each other's people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, when we did the World of Cops, Greg Mance, the chief for Griffith, was on here, and he talked about when they interview candidates, if they can't take them, they try to send them to somebody else and say, hey, here's a great candidate. We don't have room for him, but, man, you guys ought to hire him. Another department needs him. So it sounds like some of that's going on with you guys, too.
Absolutely. Yeah. And not everybody's right for every situation. I mean, there are people that would be great firefighters that might work really well in Crown Point that maybe can't work well in Portage, and vice versa. Mm-hmm. So,
how often do you let somebody go? How often do you say, this is not for you?
Well, I think if you redefine the question, we don't let people go that often.
Okay.
I think in Portage's world anyway, a lot of times what happens is the people realize that this isn't for them. It's not so much we're telling them it's not for them. They, in a lot of our cases, they realize, hey, this isn't for me, so I need to step back.
I would agree. We have the same thing happen. We have people that leave for other professions or go to other departments. We generally don't have to make those decisions. Yeah. They happen on their own.
It works out.
Yep.
So let's talk a little bit about this training side, because you both keep talking about this education. Both you're educating people, and you need to keep a really highly educated person, be a firefighter and a paramedic. So where do they get all this training? And there's this new training center now, it's going to be opening up here.
We've already used it.
Yeah,
it's being used currently.
Last weekend there was 100 firefighters training.
Okay. So what kind of training is going on in these, and what does this center this academy bring to our region?
Well, we talked earlier about when both of us started, most of it was on-the-job training. And I think just like other trades and other industries, it's evolved into a much more complex training program. And a lot of the departments tried to do it in-house originally, and now we've taken more of a regional approach. After the events of 9/11, the state organized into 10 districts, and we kind of agreed to not fight fireworks anymore, and in order to get some funding to provide firefighter training. So that's actually where our firefighter funding comes from for training, is from the fireworks tax. So that tax money goes to providing funding. So District 1 is here, Lake Porter, LaPorte, Newton, and Jasper County. And we provide training to, you know, nearly 70-some fire departments and about 2,000 firefighters, because the departments just can't do it themselves. Back in the day, you know, there used to be training facilities at each department. You know, Gary had their own, and East Chicago had their own, Munster had their own, Portage did their own. Even the volunteer departments did training within their own departments. But it just became too demanding, one, because we have too many other efforts that we're doing, and two, you know, sometimes you don't have enough people. You know, maybe bring one guy on at a time. It's difficult to train one firefighter at a time.
Well, and your training is only as good as your best person, and you may have a better person who's really good at something in another department who could be a great teacher for that. Right.
So with this new training facility that we've been needing for a long time, we're able to bring all those folks together. So we're getting ready to start a career academy that Tom will have folks in. We're going to have probably 11 or 12 people from various departments, I think five or six different departments in the area in three different counties, Lake, Porter, and LaPorte County. And they'll come together and they'll train together at the facility.
What's the hardest thing to teach someone besides
caring? Because
caring.
Can't teach them that.
Right.
Well,
what seems like it's really a challenge to get people to grasp?
I think one of the hardest things it is to teach people, especially if we're just talking about fires for a second, one of the hardest things is their SCBA and understanding. You know, you're kind of in a claustrophobic situation when you have your pack on. As you're breathing in the air and you know, everything's kind of closed in on your face. The hardest thing to get people to understand is when you're uncomfortable, not to take that stuff off. Because that's the definite killer right there, because the atmosphere around you is going to kill you. But I think it's just kind of in human nature to go, well, I don't like all this on me, so I need to get it off. And I think that's one of the areas where when we see people who struggle, that's probably one of the biggest areas that we see them struggle in is this is your life safety. Don't remove it.
That's interesting. I wouldn't have thought about it.
And that's where the MAC training facility comes in, because not only can we put them in those training scenarios, but we can have facilities or structures or props that create a stressed environment that you can't duplicate without those facilities. So I'm talking a live fire training facility, a flashover chamber, even search and rescue facilities that have reduced visibility, so that you can exercise those things and put them under that stressed environment to see how they react and train them how to react. Because we can't duplicate in the firehouse. We can't set our firehouse on fire and put them in for training. But we can simulate fire at the training facility and put them under those stress conditions to make sure that they know how to react properly.
Which is probably the other difficult piece of this, is how to deal with the stress of those immediate situations.
Absolutely. So when Mike and I started, you know, like we said already, my first fire was at Mrs. Smith's house in downtown. And, you know, you're doing it. You're there and you're doing it, and the smoke and the heat and everything's coming down on you, and the reality of, you know, I'm going to come across Mrs. Smith and maybe have to pull her out of this building, all that stuff is hitting you right then and there when you're actually doing it.
So this is literally the trial by fire kind of thing.
Yeah,
right?
That's not the time where I decide, you know what, I don't think I need to be a firefighter, right? That's the time when I have to do the job. But now with facilities like the MAC, we're able to put them in those stressed environments where
I can start small.
Yeah.
I can just put smoke on them. No heat, just smoke. Now you can't see. Function without seeing. And then when they can do that, then we add the heat.
We're down just a few seconds, but if there was one message you would like people to understand about safety, what would it be? One message from either one of you.
Well, I think one of the biggest things that we're pushing right now, and I think every fire department does this, if we look at just overall safety, smoke detectors. You know, there's always been a huge push in Portage to have smoke detectors, and you need to, you know, make sure your smoke detectors work and that they're functioning.
You've got them. One quick one from you.
There's so many. I would agree with the smoke detectors. That's a great one because so many fires we go to and they don't have operational smoke detectors. It really is critical.
Well, maybe having a double message on that will sink into a few people. So I really appreciate you being on the show. I appreciate all you do for our communities. And just listening to you today, I'm definitely feeling safer. So this is good. I'm not going to make sure I trip either. So thanks for being here, guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Lakeshore Focus airs on Friday nights at 7:30, and it's rebroadcast Sundays at 9:30 a.m. on Lakeshore PBS. Indigenous communities are spread across Canada. Some are remote. Some are very close to the U.S. border. But they all have something in common, in some cases, unsafe drinking water. Great Lakes Today's Elizabeth Miller visited a reservation for the last story in our series on environmental justice.
The Six Nations of the Grand River Reserve is just 70 miles from Buffalo. It's an easy drive, down one-lane roads and past field after field of farmland. I stop into a classroom in the Haudenosaunee Community Center, where about 10 men are learning about a funeral ritual. But when I arrive, Leroy Hill shifts the conversation to a new topic, water.
Is there anybody here who don't have to either buy water or get it hauled?
I have to buy water.
You live by water, Jack?
Some of the men have contaminated water wells in their backyards. Some have wells without water. Others just don't drink the water because they don't trust it.
I don't think any of us sitting here really have, like, good water.
Six Nations has a boil water advisory for residents who rely on well water. It's been in place for nearly 20 years. So the folks who live here have to get their water in other ways. One man says it cost $80 to fill a cistern every 2 months. Some residents go to a station in the center of town to fill tanks, and others, especially older people, pay to have their water delivered. Hill says Six Nations deserves better treatment from Canadian officials.
The government said we'll manage it and we'll provide your services. That's the agreement. And they're doing a piss-poor job.
Contaminated drinking water is a big problem for Canada's Indigenous communities, known as First Nations. There are currently 67 long-term advisories designed to protect residents from bacteria and other harmful contaminants. In some communities, the Canadian government warns residents not to use the water at all, even for washing up. Lizanne Baldeck of Indigenous Services Canada says the goal is to remove all advisories by 2021, in addition to repairing and replacing water treatment facilities.
We would like to see as fast as possible, and we are committed to supporting First Nation as quickly as possible resolve these issues, recognizing that infrastructure does take some time to be implemented.
The Canadian government has pledged $1.8 billion to resolve the First Nations problem. But Six Nations experience shows it's not an easy fix. In 2013, a new $41 million water treatment plant opened in the community. That provided the capacity to serve the whole community. Half of its 27,000 members live on reserve. Operators went from producing 12 liters a second to 50. But Public Works Director Michael Montour says there's still one part missing, the customers.
That stat is about 9% of our population then is serviced directly from the water treatment plant.
The cost of connecting the entire community to the plant is $200 million. And that probably won't happen anytime soon because the problem across Canada is so enormous. Some First Nations don't even have a water treatment plant, so they're a higher priority for government funding.
There's over 600 First Nations in Canada, over 130 in Ontario. So once that actually trickles down, I mean, that's not a big number.
But there is a new project that may shed some light on water quality issues in Six Nations. It's led by Don Martin Hill, Indigenous Studies professor at McMaster University and resident of the Six Nations Reserve. The project will figure out what contaminates water sources here and how to solve long-standing problems.
I think Americans and Canadians are now going to understand in the very short, near future why they shouldn't be taking water for granted, because it is a precious resource. It's blue gold.
The project has funding for 3 years, and Martin Hill says she's already received requests for help from other Indigenous communities. For Great Lakes Today, I'm Elizabeth Miller.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for being with us. Tomorrow it's Thursday, Reporters Roundtable Thursday, and from the Times, Bill Dolan and Carmen McCollum will join us, as well as from Inside Indiana Business, Dan McGowan. Hope you'll join us for that.